Chapter 10. The head landed in the dust in front of Katha, azure light fading from its eyes, its clockwork jaw hanging limp in an expression of shock and awe.
"Well fought," it said.
"Good, Gleeback," Katha said.
She took a swig from her flask, grimaced, and kicked the head back to the goblin.
"Good,"
said the goblin. He pulled his old dagger from the target point on the training golem's throat, one of several large red spheres sprouting from strategically vulnerable points on the automaton, like crimson fruit on a tree of iron and polished wood.
"You're almost done with your knife drills," she said,
which meant she was another step closer to not having to play trainer. She took a celebratory drink from her flask.
"Good. Nuff."
She watched the goblin set the golem's head back in its socket and lock it into place. The golem's gemstone eyes lit up once more.
"Hail, mighty warrior,"
it said in an ethereal, jilted stammer.
"Shall we duel?"
Katha looked across the horizon. Stars lit up one by one in the deep blue sky above the orange horizon. Last light would fade soon.
"No, we're done for the night," she told the golem. Another celebratory drink. "Let's pack up."
"Until next we meet," declared the golem.
The automaton bent over, tucked its arms up behind its back, and neatly folded itself into a small box. Katha instructed Gleeback to shove the compact golem into a large satchel.
"Where's Niln?" she asked.
"Top-o-bop,"
said Gleeback, pointing back toward the campsite. Katha looked. Niln cowered behind his tent, glancing around nervously.
"What are you doing?"
she hollered to him.
"No, don't,"
the high scribe said, but it was too late. Niln's training golem lunged from the other side of the tent, wooden blade in hand.
"Uh-huh, knave. I have you now,"
it intoned, and charged at Niln. The high scribe raised his staff in feeble defense, but one blow from the golem's sword knocked the weapon from Niln's hands. The automaton thrust forward again, and while attempting a desperate dodge, Niln reached out and slapped the training golem across the face. Whatever spells animated the golem had not prepared it for a slap to the face, and its assault halted in the confusion.
"Did I break it?" asked Niln.
The golem reached out and slapped him across the face as its mimicry enchantments activated. Niln slapped it in return. Scribe and golem traded another round of smacks, gave each other an incredulous gasp, and launched into a vigorous slap fight.
"By the gods,"
said Katha, holding her face in her palm.
If I might have some assistance,
pleaded Niln, trying to land blows on the golem's head while craning his own face away from the automaton's relentless assault.
"Niln, what are you doing?"
Katha strode into the melee and casually administered a couple of punches to the golem's weak points. Its left arm and head went sailing across the plains in a rush of steam and wind.
"I was defending myself," said Niln. "You don't defend against training golems," said Katha. "They can't actually hurt you. They're for learning to kill."
The golem's head finally landed a few yards away.
"Ah, a blow. Well struck," it said.
I've heard it said that the best offense is a good defense," said Niln. "You don't have a good defense," said Katha. "You can't use a shield. You can't deflect a blow. I'd swear you were trying to dodge into your opponent's strikes. And now you've lost a slap fight to a training golem."
Niln retrieved the golem's arm.
"I acknowledge that there's room for improvement," he said. "There's just no foundation for it," said Katha.
Gleeback handed her the construct's erstwhile head.
"No training, no martial experience, no combat drills, and we're only days away from the Mirewood. If you think you're going to be ready for that, then you really have been touched by the All-Mother. I mean, not to be insensitive. My family used to say it about me all the time when I was acting rebellious or
crazy."
"Yes, I know,"
said Niln, sticking the arm back in its socket. He took the golem's head from Katha and set it in place.
"Hail, mighty warrior," it said.
"Pack yourself up, please," said Niln.
The golem cheerfully tucked itself away. Katha couldn't find words, and given where she'd steered the conversation thus far, she surmised that was for the best. She caught herself scratching at her bracers. She always did that when she needed a potion or two. It had been days since her last hit. Niln hoisted the golem onto his shoulder, and would have fallen over backward had Katha not caught him. Together they returned to their makeshift training circle and started packing the gear away for the night.
people wonder why we follow a goddess who is so...
eccentric, said Niln. Caitha maintained a diplomatic silence. The All-Mother is lost, said the High Scribe, looking up at the stars. She yearns for something she cannot name, like a hunger for a food untasted, like a love for someone you've never met. She's been searching for so long that there's nothing to her but the want and the emptiness. That's what drove her mad.
Caitha could identify with a deep and resonant longing, although she knew that 5 minutes alone with a knife and a vial of elixir would fix hers.
We follow her because we feel the same hollowness, the need for something that we cannot name, the call of something we cannot hear. We see that the world is wrong, but we don't know the solution.
And you think Almatra will find it? Caitha asked.
She's the only god who's searching.
Caitha nodded. Fair enough.
You do not seem so different from the All-Mother. Not to me.
Caitha interrupted him. Look, a lesson on Almatran philosophy is well and good, but don't go passing judgment on me. You don't know me.
I know you drink until you cannot walk, even when we are to leave early in the morning. I know that this isn't the first job like that. That's different.
Is it? Niln asked.
Are you sure you don't miss what you never had, or search for something you cannot name?
I know exactly what I want, snapped Caitha. I want my career back.
Then why did you take up drink when you had it?
Said Niln, pointing at the flask in Caitha's hand.
When you were at the pinnacle of the heroics industry, what did you hope to find at the bottom of a bottle?
Words failed Caitha. She wanted another hit of healing potion, but more than that, she wanted to not have another hit, and to not need it.
Perhaps you were touched by the lady after all, said Niln. Good night, Caitha. May you find what you are looking for.
Caitha mumbled a good night, and then dismissed Gleebec as well. She packed away the folded golems and the rest of the training gear. Then she drained her flask, and upon finding it empty, promptly refilled it from the bottle of Marvelous Marvo's famous halfling rum that she kept in her belt pouch. For a time, she drank in silence and watched the stars above the plains. The flask was halfway empty again when Laruna stormed by, sparks flying from the Solomancer's grinding teeth and flames writhing around her fists. The mage stalked past the ranger without so much as a glance. Caitha watched her go with another swig. A moment later, Jin followed the mage. Something about the man's walk annoyed Caitha, his back always straight and rigid as a high birch, his nose always held up and away as though avoiding an unpleasant smell. He looked down at her with the serene condescension of an ancient statue.
I see you're drinking again, naturally.
And I see your lesson went as well as ever, she shot back. Jin's lip curled slightly as he watched Laruna storm back to camp.
It's neither my fault nor my concern if she has no head for higher learning.
Of course it is. If I can teach a goblin to use a stave and knife properly, you should be able to teach one of the most gifted mages I've ever seen how to weave a better spell. Not that we need you to. She's out fighting you.
You should focus less on the affairs of mages and more on sobering up enough to make yourself useful.
Caitha took another swig of rum, stood up, and cracked her knuckles. Her earlier conversation with Niln still didn't sit well with her, and Marvelous Marvo's never sat well with anyone, so if the rank one wizard wanted to lecture her on effectiveness, she wasn't going to take it sitting down. She stretched, stepped toward Jin, and gave him a kidney punch that would put an ogre on the floor. The wizard crumpled into her arms with a squeal.
If you knew me half as well as you think you do, you'd know that I'm a violent drunk, she hissed into his ear.
She grabbed the wizard's hand and twisted it behind his back.
I am the High Counselor of the Circle of the Red Hawk, he spat through gritted teeth.
And that plus a Gilton will get you a fish on market day, growled Caitha. We're in the field, where the fights are to the death, and nobody is going to challenge you to a duel and stand 10 paces away before they try to kill you. What good is being a High Counselor if you're so green that a few lizard men almost took you down?
I don't have to prove myself to you, he snarled, struggling in her grip.
Perhaps not, but until you do, you've got nothing to say to me about being useful, new blood. Understood?
Caitha took a long, burning pull from her flask, daring the wizard to say something. Jin grimaced at the smell of the rum, but he remained silent in a rare display of wisdom. She could tell by his eyes, specifically in the way they never met her own,
that she'd made her point. Some men were too proud to ever admit defeat. The closest they came to surrender was learning to keep their mouths shut.
Good,
she said, giving the wizard a shove, and left him without another word. The satisfaction of putting Jin in his place had faded before she reached the campfire. It didn't change what had become of her career. It didn't make Niln any less right about the hunger, the emptiness that plagued her. She exchanged half-hearted waves with the heroes around the fire as she made her way to her tent. Inside, she found her rucksack with the false bottom and the vials of elixir secreted within. She didn't know what she was searching for, let alone how to find it, or if it existed at all. But she did have a private space, a sharp knife, and a bottle of blissful ignorance. For a short while, that was enough. Ebonmire was little more than a few farms scattered around an old inn, all within the shadow of Arth's most deadly swamp. The village was surrounded by overgrown foundations and rotting frames of buildings long gone, the skeletal remains of more prosperous times when the Mirewood's inhabitants were as wealthy as they were terrible. Lilacs grew around the ruins. Small baubles had been hung from every post. Seashells and glass globes and beads dangled from every nail, all one shade of purple or another. Beyond the ruined town, the black trees of the Mirewood seethed. After several days spent walking the empty road and several nights sleeping on the rocky plains, Ebonmire looked like an oasis to Gorm.
"Please tell me they have heated baths," said Laruna, as the heroes rode toward the inn, "with lavender soaps."
"And spiced wine," said Jin. "A good elven vintage with imperial spices."
"And a pretty barmaid," said Haraldin. "A cute and lonely thing with a set of..."
"Thank you, Haraldin," Niln interrupted.
"Don't set your hopes too high,"
said Gorm, eyeing the inn's rotting rooftop. As a general rule, the best inn in any given area was only ever slightly more comfortable than the best alternative sleeping arrangement, and this particular inn was competing with some ruins and a deadly swamp.
"We'll be lucky for a hot meal and a bed without fleas."
"I'd settle for a wash bin by the fire," said Laruna, holding out hope.
"Anything that's not stale grog will do, really," said Jin.
"Honestly, if she's got all her limbs and half her teeth, thank you, Haraldin."
The Red Sow managed somehow to disappoint on every account. The only bath was a wooden basin in the barn. The bar served stale grog and cold sandwiches exclusively. The closest thing the inn had to a barmaid was the tavern keeper's ill-tempered wife. Haraldin was convinced the tavern was named for her. On a happier note, the innumerable fleas and midges that had taken up residence in the sow's beds had starved to death long ago, and once their corpses were dusted away, the mattresses were serviceable. It was getting late at that point, so Gorm and Katha went to settle the bill.
"We'll be headed out at dawn, and we don't want to wake you," Gorm told the tavern keeper.
"Oh, I'm up by then for sure," said the tavern keeper.
"Well, then we don't want to wake your wife," said Gorm.
They all looked to the barkeep's wife. She glared up from sweeping the floor, made a sound like a gravelly wretch at them, and shuffled into the back room.
"Fair enough," said the tavern keeper. 42 gilton, 3 shillings and 6 cents.
As Gorm counted out several 10 gilton notes and a handful of coins, the barkeep added,
"Don't suppose you're going to the Mirewood?"
"Don't suppose there's many other reasons to be in Ebonmire," said Gorm.
"Have you got your purple?"
"I beg your pardon," said Katha.
"Your purple, for the king in the wood?"
Sensing entrepreneurial opportunity, the tavern keeper lifted an old crate of seashells, painted beads, and handkerchiefs from beneath the bar. The crate said in thick, crude lettering, "Purple, 5 shillings each.
5 shillings for a string of beads?" said Gorm.
"And a bargain at that. It's the color that counts, you see. You know, like the kids used to sing, 'Carry purple, king to pay, a price to keep the dark away.' No, never heard it?"
"Can't say as I have," said Gorm.
"Well, it's a fairly simple transaction, really. People fall into peril in the Mirewood, the king saves them, and they leave him a bit of purple as thanks. Your king risks his life traveling the swamp in the hopes that people will tip him purple trinkets," said Katha. "It ain't like that. Probably not, anyways. Nobody's seen him, you see. Some say he's one of the old gods roaming far from the Pantheon, or the spirit of the swamp, or an ancient elven hero from the Fifth Age.
"Or an excuse to sell painted trash to passers-by," said Gorm.
"Say what you will," sniffed the barkeep. "Gods know I've seen my share of cynics, and as many as not have come out of that wood swearin' they was saved by the king, and thankin' us for making them take a simple scrap of purple. It's our civic duty."
"How benevolent of you," said Gorm.
"Oh, not me," said the barkeep. "It's my wife. She just can't stand the idea of poor souls risking their lives in the swamp by going out without a scrap of purple to protect them. Can you, Berlinda?"
The backroom door burst open. The barkeep's wild-eyed wife, a rotund, grimacing apparition, rooted in the darkness beyond it.
"They're gone without purple!" she shrieked.
The barkeep's smile oozed neighborly concern, but his eyes were the eyes of a salesman, predatory and calculating.
"Why, my Berlinda could talk for hours about the dangers of going into the wood unprepared."
Gorm and Katha shared a look, and found, unsurprisingly, that they had both reassessed the value of carrying a purple. Gorm slapped a 5 gilton note on the bar.
"We'll take 8, he said.
The barkeep gave Gorm a triumphant wink.
"And a bargain at that," he repeated.
Sweat beaded on Laruna's brow. It took immense effort to restrain the flames that wanted to come roaring through her arms and out of her hands. A tiny plume of magic sprouted from the air an inch above her upturned palm, slowly spiraling into existence. It cast a warm glow onto the wooden posts and stone blocks that had once been an Ebonmire home. She bent her middle finger toward the strand of magic in her palm and shot a small stream of fire from it, bisecting the path the sorcery channeled through. The thread in her hand split into 2 streams, spiraling in opposite directions. She positioned her thumb and little finger to split the strands again, so that 4 strands of pyromancy danced in long, twirling arcs from her hand, like a glowing golden bloom. She was startled to hear soft footsteps approaching, and as she jumped, her weave changed course again. The threads began to cross back and forth, taking on a new shape.
"Laruna,"
Jin called, and her concentration was shot. Flames surged through her, and the spell began to wobble and come apart as excess power coursed through it. She tried to correct the weave, but the spell twisted into a clumsy snarl of magic. Her spell wobbled uncertainly for a moment, then slid awkwardly from her palm and landed with a warm hiss on the floor of the ruined house just as the Noctomancer stepped inside. For a moment, both mages stared in silence at the dying glow of the failed spell. As it sizzled and sputtered out, anger and embarrassment flared within her.
"What are you doing out here?" she demanded.
Jin scratched at the patch of raven hair on his chin, clearly uncomfortable.
I see you're practicing your spells without me now."
"That's no concern of yours," she snapped. "It's bad enough the dwarf sends me to your so-called lessons. What I do on my own time is my own business."
"You misunderstand," said the Noctomancer, sitting atop a ruined bench with a heavy sigh. "When I was an apprentice, I had a cruel master whose lessons confused me, and he'd say that I... well, he didn't think much of me, and let's leave it at that. So I'd sneak away to practice spells on my own. And that's how I really learned, practicing my own magic. But I forgot that as I grew. All I remembered is how he taught me, and it became how I taught." He gestured to the charred mark on the floor. "And now I'm the cruel one, and you're sneaking off to practice. Perhaps we are not so different, you and I."
"Stop patronizing me," Laruna said. "You're not my master, cruel or thick-headed or otherwise, and I'm not your apprentice, nor am I a child. And don't fool yourself into thinking we're alike just because your private tutor made you cry when you were a boy. I'm nothing like you. I grew up eating dirt for dinner and getting beaten if I took too much sod. I've fought for everything I have."
"But you," she snarled, practically spitting the pronoun, "I know your type. You were some rich little brat under the tutelage of a powerful wizard because your father could buy you a spot at the academy.
The whole world's been handed to you on a platter, and here you are moaning that the plate was tarnished.
His jaw set, and she saw anger flash in his eyes and braced herself for a fight. Yet Jin's retaliation never came. Instead, the wizard stared into the ruined house's fireplace and shook his head.
"Is that it?" she demanded. "Or do you have something else to say before you leave me in peace?"
His voice was softer than a whisper.
"How do you do it?"
"What?"
"How do you fight when it's not a duel? When you don't know the rules? No, when there are no rules and there's no academy to enforce them? When you're not fighting mages?"
"I don't see how it's any different," said Laruna, caught off guard. "You just fight."
"It's totally different," said Jin. "I know magic. In a duel, I know what my opponent will do, what they should do. I can sense a spell coming. I've bested mages who outrank me, and those who have far more capacity to channel. But out here, I can't sense a knife coming, nor do I know when or how a lizard man will strike. And so, while I'm considering my next move, before I have time to even think of what to do, you step in and just...
His hand swept away an imaginary horde of foes.
Laruna tried to find the hidden insult, the slight she knew the wizard must have been trying to infer.
"So, you're saying I don't think?"
He turned to look at her again, his blue eyes piercing. "On the contrary, I'm saying you think well on your feet. It's one of the things I admire about you." Laruna took a step backwards, reeling from the compliment. Though perhaps that was his intention, she realized. If he wanted to put her off guard, there probably wasn't any better way to do it. She recovered quickly and changed topics in a decisive counterattack.
"Then give me your vote to make me a full mage."
His smile made it plain he had seen through her ploy. "You know as well as I do that magehood isn't about the power you wield, but about the control you have over it."
"Control," she snorted. "You mean how fancy your weaves are? I'm sick of hearing about it, sick of seeing apprentices that couldn't hold a candle to me getting advanced just because they can stitch together a few threads of sorcery."
Unpleasant memories of the academy surfaced in her mind, of long days wearing apprentice robes that were far too small, sitting in a classroom full of peers who weren't half her age.
"I heard the other apprentices talking. Even though they were just children, they'd call me stupid and say I'd never learn to weave."
"And deep down, you wondered if they were right," said Jin, watching the stars overhead. "And you couldn't help but think that if so many people thought that of you, if the whole world believed you incapable, then maybe you really were as worthless as they said." The wizard's words held no derision or mockery, just a wistful sadness. And something else, perhaps familiarity?
"Yes," said Laruna, watching the Noctomancer's face carefully. "Has that ever happened to you?"
"Oh, no, of course not," said Jin. "But I did... I know the sting of harsh words. You must not listen to them. When people insult you, remember that they don't know you, not in your fathoms. Only you know what powers echo there."
"You called me an idiot."
"Prove me wrong, Laruna. Show the world the real strength inside you." The wizard stood. "I can help you with that, and you, in turn, can teach me to fight." Laruna stared at him with open doubt. The man's words were well and good, but he was still Jin. He was the counselor whose vote denied her full magehood, and who was indirectly responsible for her involvement in this sorry excuse for a quest. Jin seemed to sense her hesitation. "I've been tasked with teaching you to weave, and I want to learn how to fight," he said. "I cannot succeed in either if you fail. I'm not asking you to trust me, just to recognize that our interests are aligned." He extended a hand to her. "We have nothing to lose and power to gain." Laruna wasn't sure that was the case. Still, it wasn't like there was much of a choice. Gorm would insist she train with the Noctomancer, no matter what. If nothing else, Jin's sudden change would make her mandated lessons a lot more tolerable. She took his hand and shook it. Tuamus polished the blade of his short sword vigorously. The enchanted blade crackled with sorcerous lightning that singed his knuckles, but he kept scrubbing long after he could see his reflection in the rune steel. He'd been cleaning his gear since the cart had rolled away, leaving his team to their task. His armor and shield were already polished to a mirror finish, his boots were immaculate, and his cloak unsullied. He told the others that his rigorous cleaning regimen was a mark of professionalism, but they just laughed and shook their heads. Everyone else in the company had been a licensed thug for years, and recognized a nervous rookie when they saw one. There was a lot to be nervous about. Tuamus had been a goon for his entire career up until now. Gooning was good work, if a little dull. Easy, simple, low risk. Nothing like thuggery. Thugs had to deal with heroes, which never seemed to turn out well for the thugs in all the bard's stories. Sure, there were the great thug legends, mighty individuals who took down hundreds of heroes during their tenure with the Thugs Union, but they were vastly outnumbered by the vast throng of thugs who had promising careers cut short, stabbed, incinerated, melted, or otherwise violently ended by professional heroes. Even with the venerable Damrod the Eye fighting by their side, and the fact that their marks were rumored to be a bunch of new bloods led by a few washed-up drunks, there was a good chance someone on the crew wasn't going to survive the ambush. Of course, that assumed they survived until the ambush. Tuamus had been told it was at least a day away, which meant spending nights in the middle of the Mirewood, nights waiting in dank caves while blackness closed in around them, nights fighting whatever terrors skittered from the darkness, nights spent sitting next to... Tuamus shook his head and resumed polishing his blade with renewed vigor.
"Problem, kid?"
Hogar asked him. The senior thug was a wiry man whose face boasted more scars than teeth.
"I just don't know why we had to do the ambush in the Mirewood."
"Same reason we do everything," laughed Hogar, "to avoid paperwork."
The death of any hero, even a rank one fighter, prompted an automatic guild investigation to determine who was responsible. This was usually less a matter of blame than fiscal responsibility, but when thugs were involved, the Heroes Guild went to extra lengths to investigate the killing of its members. The law left a gray area around thugs and heroes fighting or slaying each other, but every thug knew that some jobs were of a darker shade. In those cases, it was best to head off any inquiry by outside authorities. The trick was that the degree of proof that guild coroners and medical investigators required was inversely proportional to the degree of risk in the investigation. When a hero was found dead in the street, a full forensic autopsy was usually needed to satisfy the guild's counsel, but proving that a party of heroes entered a flame drake lair and didn't exit again was usually enough to end any inquiry. Such a practice made deadly locales like the Mirewood, the Black Gorge, and the Ash Wastes the best places for thugs to handle any business they'd rather keep quiet. Listing the Mirewood as the cause of a hero's death would settle any investigation. The benefits of conducting the ambush in the middle of a deadly swamp had been explained to Tuamus several times over, and he understood the theory. Yet, sitting among the black trees, Tuamus was certain he'd have rather dealt with a mountain of paperwork than spend another hour in the swamp.
"Keep your eyes forward, Tuamus," barked Damrod.
"Aye, sir,"
said Tuamus, standing. Damrod the Eye was called as much for the single leering eye that stared from his knobby, scarred face. The old mercenary stood in the entry to the cave, flanked by the other four veteran thugs, rain dripping down from his crimson cloak.
"And stop looking back at the stiffs."
"Yes, sir,"
said Tuamus, joining the others at the mouth of the cave. He pulled his cloak tighter around him, guarding against a chill from the enchanted bricks of ice sitting in the cave behind them. They stood and watched the darkness brood outside the torchlight.
"How come yous didn't bring the mask along with yous?"
said Big Blenny, who followed the ancient thug's union tradition of adding an S to the end of every pronoun.
"He's on other business," said Damrod.
Something in the distant darkness roared, and then shrieked as it was eaten by something larger and more deadly. Tuamus was a little embarrassed to discover that he was subconsciously polishing his shield again.
"Hey, where's Davitt?"
said Big Blenny. Tuamus looked all around. Classy Davitt had been at the end of the line, sitting on a large stone that was now occupied by his ominously discarded top hat.
"Eyes forward, lads," Damrod said.
He drew his sword, and the rest of the thugs readied their weapons. Tuamas thought he heard something behind him, a wet slap or a low shuffle. It was hard to tell, because things were definitely moving outside the cave as well.
"Eyes forward, thrice curse you, Tuamas!"
roared Damrod. Tuamas startled to attention.
"Sorry, sir, I thought I heard something back by the—"
"Never you mind the cave! You keep your thrice-cursed eyes on the woods! Don't you worry about those bloody corpses! They've been dead for weeks!"
Damrod was cut off by a shriek. Dead green arms grabbed Vondo Tarmouth by the head and pulled him screaming back into the cave.
"That is not as much of an impediment as one might think," said a cold, hollow voice from the darkness.
"Weapons up!" roared Damrod. "Ready yourselves, lads! Stay— Arrgh!"
Something seized the screaming mercenary and hauled him into the dark woods. Tuamas readied his sword. He saw Hogar dragged into the shadows outside the cave, and Big Blenny fleeing into the woods. All around him he heard shrieks and wails and inhuman growls.
"Stay back!" he shouted. "Stay back! I warn you!"
The shadows were unswayed by the mercenary's commands. Unnatural figures stalked toward him from the darkness.
"Please, stay back!"
Classy Davitt stepped into the torchlight, his eyes dull and lifeless, his head hanging sideways from his thick, broken neck. The corpse jerked and lurched like a marionette at the mercy of a drunken puppeteer as he approached Tuamas.
"Davitt! Davitt! It's me, Tuamas!"
Davitt stopped.
"Yes, it's me! Remember? Remember how we talked about finding nice girls back home? You don't have to...
Davitt's body bent down, picked up his fallen top hat, and placed it carefully atop the upturned side of his face.
"Oh, never mind the bloody hat,"
said the voice in the darkness.
"Be quick about it."
Classy Davitt groaned something in response and staggered forward once more. The last thing Tuamas saw was the overdressed corpse staggering toward him with outstretched arms.